the last of the Pentateuch, Deuteronomy 34, a brief little chapter of 12 verses. And now we hear the word of the Lord. Then Moses ascended from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali in the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negeb and the plain, that is, the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. And the Lord said to him, "This is the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go into it." So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands upon him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded unto Moses. And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, none like him for all the signs and the wonders that the Lord sent to him in order that he might accomplish them in the land of Egypt, unto Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of Israel. May God bless the reading of his word. Well, this is a mountaintop experience for Moses, and we are familiar with these from Scripture, particularly with the life of Jesus, the Mount of Transfiguration, that theophany which revealed him uniquely as both human and divine in a way that was unprecedented and even unexpected, a message to his disciples of who he is, what he does, and why he's here. Jesus also occasionally would seek solace in deserted, lonely places, including mountaintops. But we know the mountain from the life of Moses, in particular from the so-called Sinai shuttle. Moses going up and down, about 7 or 8 times, ascending Mount Sinai. It became, in effect, a tabernacle annex for the Decalogue process. The Ten Commandments did not happen overnight, but involved a significant period of time on Sinai with various visitations. But now, Moses is on Nebo, a heretofore unknown place to us, and there he experiences a very peaceful passing. You and I can stipulate with certainty some very positive presumptions about the death of Moses in this circumstance. He has accommodations which are regal and royal for the time. People are watching over him. He has permanent food, shelter, and clothing. He even has water up there. He's no longer nomadic in a tent. He has everything he needs. He is not an embittered and incarcerated shut-in who is haunted by what-ifs. His eyes are undimmed, which is a euphemism meaning that his mind is alert and he still has all his faculties and wisdom. And there's an unusual Hebrew turn of phrase here that says his spirit is supple, which is like green wood or green cords of wood, such that tied Samson. He is therefore aware and alert, cognizant. But the reason he's there goes back to Meriboth Kadesh Barnea in the Zin Desert. What a place name that is. Wouldn't you like to go visit the Zin Desert? Experience some tranquility out there with the rocks and the sand and the cacti. There he was at that place about 1 year or more into the pilgrimage out of Egypt. They had already experienced such miraculous deliverance and provision. Amazing story, as you well know. The Israelites are released after a visitation of 10 plagues, and try as we might to explain them scientifically, they still are branded by the timing of God, and there's some of them that simply cannot be explained by modern phenomenon. Now, not only that, but they pass through a body of water and not even are clogged with mud, but rather it's dry land to them. And then, rather than simply be swamped and inundated or thwarted, the entire Egyptian armada is sunk and drowned, such as the endeviled pigs at the Gerasene demoniac. And now they're on the threshold of this entry. They have provisions day in and day out that are sufficient for their needs, but there's a failure to launch. Now, this is the same place where Abraham had defeated the Amalekites in Genesis 14, and it will later be the site of the death of Miriam, the sister of Moses. But imagine that they pay attention to the spies who are spooked by the inhabitants of Canaan and don't listen to Caleb and Joshua or the counsel of Moses, and instead choose to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Failure to launch. And now it's 38 years later, and there's this process that's ongoing in which God has called and winnowed out that faithless, derelict generation of ingrates. And once again, we have been there and done that. The people of Israel whine and complain and moan and groan in self-pity. They have sufficient food in the manna. They've always had water on occasion, although they had to wait for it. But oh no, they don't want to wait. They begin to beseech Moses as if God has forsaken them. And once again, in the same way, he's instructed to strike the rock. But instead, this time, he bashes it twice with his staff and uses a formula that indicates he's doing it rather than it's the Lord's action, rather than he's a vessel of God's wonder works. He loses his manners, basically, and oversteps his bounds. He fails to honor the Lord, as he has done well for 38, 39 40, 41, 42 years. Long time. It's a bad moment for Moses. Now that he's on Nebo about to die, and let's freeze frame it there for just a minute. Not eisegete it, but still exegete. Eisegesis is always a heresy. That means to read into the text your own agenda. Let's take out of it what the Lord's agenda is, always. Go by the clues and the implications and the presumptions that are left for us, so much like a trail of breadcrumbs leading us back to that pot of gold of God's truth. What do you think the people are thinking? What do you think they are ruminating in their mind as they look off in the distance at Mount Nebo? There they are in Canaan, in the valleys, in the fertile lands. Sort of like the Sooners of the land rush in 1906. They're already in there staking their claims and marking their territory and nesting and settling and just having a big time living a life of permanence rather than nomadic itinerancy. And there's Moses off in the distance. He brought them there. His job description has been changed. He no longer will take them into the promised land, but up to the promised land. And now they see he's not a part of their transition. What do you imagine they are thinking? If there's any shred of decency left in them, they're thinking it's our fault. We're to blame. We deserve the moniker of a stiff-necked motley mob of a bunch of ingrates and complainers who are always on the brink of betrayal. We have a rap sheet of heresies and misconduct to beat the band. They have manna every day. Instead of being grateful for it, they want to diversify their menu, and so they gripe about the absence of meat. So the Lord sends pigeons, which is the real word that we euphemize with doves, or turtle doves, as if turtles could fly. And then we have this plethora of meat, and such that the Hebrew says it's coming out their noses more than they can eat. They want water, not just that little trickle or an occasional oasis, but a wellspring, and the Lord provides them an artesian, bubbling surge of fountain that's so much so they cannot absorb it, assimilate it, or cart it off. It's more than they need or could possibly use. Instead of entering into the land, as mentioned previously, they choose to retreat and abdicate the very victory that the Lord has provided for them. Instead of worshiping and adoring the one who has miraculously delivered them out of Egypt, they fall into the same old trap as their captors and begin to worship an idol. Instead of focusing upon that column of smoke by day and a column of fire by night, the very tabernacle of God in their midst, they choose to fashion out an idol looking like a calf made of gold. And then they'll be forced to drink the water that's been sprinkled with the grounded dust of that gold to remind them of their bitter betrayal. It's our fault. We brought this on him. We brought this on ourselves. If there's any decency left in them, they should be at least a little bit repentant. But what is Moses' perspective? What's he thinking up there? Our job is not to know the mind of Moses, but the mind of Christ. We understand that. But you got to wonder, what's it like for him at this moment? And perhaps he's thinking, temper, temper. I should have known better. In fact, I did know better, might be what he would have told us. We remember in his early life that he was guilty of manslaughter in a pick of rage. Oh, sure, he didn't get up that morning committed to murder, but he overzealously defended an Israelite, and he beat the brains out of an Egyptian. Instead of simply administering justice, he administered capital punishment. Remember the first edition of the Ten Commandments? It's often forgotten. God had given him the Ten Commandments. He came down and saw that horrible spectacle of not only idolatry, but something worthy of a Hollywood pornography, a descent into heresy and misconduct that was just God-forsaken and abominable. And so, in a rage, he shattered the first edition of the Ten Commandments. He had no right to do that. That wasn't his book. It wasn't his work. It was God's revelation. He's been given a pass about that, but it's a part of a pattern of outbursts. But yet we know he has unprecedented intimacy with divinity. Nobody has lived a life like Moses. Nobody. He was privy to sights and sounds you and I will not know until the eternal. Constantly. Such that his face was aglow and he had to cover his countenance with a veil. He had an uneclipsed role in humanity, not just with Israelites, in terms of leadership, influence. He was sort of like all things to all people in a way, not totally, but in a way. But we see his flaws here at this moment. He loses all for the sacred. He, in fact, fails to, what would be an English pun, he refuses to practice sacred dread. He no longer fears the Lord with reverence, nor fears him with terror, because of the very might and perfection of the Holy. And as a result, he falls into the trap of Adam, and of course Eve too, but Adam had the primary responsibility to provide, protect for his wife, and he didn't do it. He was tempted and swayed, but he's the one who's accountable for violating the prohibition about the trees. We say the fall of Adam, not of Eve. How about Uzzah later with the ark? He seems like a fine fellow, just trying to help out. The ark starts to fall in the creek bed, and he involuntarily, perhaps, lunges for it to protect it. But no, no, no. He wasn't supposed to touch that ark, just like the tree in the garden. We have a joke about the cord at the gate crew on the track at Churchill Downs. You don't look at the cord. You don't touch the cord. You don't think about looking at the cord. You don't think about touching the cord. But thank goodness now the starter bell is remote. There's no cord. But still, those boundaries. Stay away from them. How about Ananias and Sapphira? Well, they seem to just be overdoing it a bit with their showy pretense and ostentation at the offering. But they are lying to God, lying to the people, and zap, down they go at First Baptist Jerusalem on a Sunday morning. The bottom line is that in chapter 32 of Deuteronomy, we're told that God explains it very clearly to Moses. He has broken faith with God. To break faith means to interrupt the trustworthiness. He is no longer credentialed to handle the holy as before. Now, this begs the question to us, what matters to God? We think about what matters to us all the time, but the real question is what matters to God. And Moses is highly complimented for having knowledge that led to wisdom, and wisdom that led to understanding. It's useful to have the facts and to have them organized and chronicled in our own mind and heart, but it's more meaningful once we go beyond those facts and now assimilate them in such a way that we can administer them and interpret them wisely so that we have wisdom about our knowledge. And then the ultimate prize is to have understanding that permeates all our lives in such a way that we can maintain the posture and the poise that God has planned for us. An understanding that lives for and lives unto the glory of God. That's the real goal of life, is the glory of God. And we get there not just with the facts or just by being wise, but by having an understanding of what God expects and demands of us. Now, our sense of human justice would have been quite different. If we had been in charge of Moses' destiny, if we had administrated the court's decision, we would have made equivocating excuses. We would have been all over the map saying, well, you know, Moses just needs a time out. He's having a bad day, a bad moment, and they have pushed him to the brink. Let's give him a break, a little R&R. Let's give him a sabbatic. Then also, how about a public apology, Moses? How about you do a little political cover-up here? Come out and do a mea culpa. Tell us how sorry you are. You didn't mean to offend anybody. And Lord have mercy, you won't let it happen again. Then we'll give you a little slap on the wrist. A little, and then ultimately, after that wrist slap, a mulligan. We'll let you go back to where square one and continue uninterrupted. Accountability would be mitigated and the consequences minimized, and therefore a lesson lost. There's an African fable about a mischievous monkey and a crocodile, which was really helpful at this moment. Don't you like children's stories? They give you a real break from thinking through the sermon, don't they? So now then, there's this monkey that's being raised by its clan, its mama and its papa, and it begins to experiment with its capabilities and starts to tease a crocodile that's lurking in the river. And he knows how that crocodile operates. He can see its eyes and knows it's by the riverbank ready to shoot out and snatch him. And so he starts to torment the crocodile by acting like he doesn't see him, and here I am, just play that little childhood game of tag you're it and not letting him tag him. And the mother and father say, don't tease that crocodile. He's a little better and slyer than you think. Just leave him alone. We know where he is. You do too. Leave him alone. You don't see anybody else over there messing with him. But no. The little mischievous monkey now proceeds to take it on as his daily pleasure. And one day, according to the fable, he wasn't quite attentive to the whereabouts of the crocodile. And the crocodile reached up and bit off his tail. Oh, Mama and Papa, I'm so sorry, you were right. I should not have messed with that crocodile. Will you forgive me? Oh, yes, we'll forgive you. But from now on, you can't swing from the trees. Not because we won't let you, but because you haven't got a tail. You'll have to climb everywhere you go the hard way. There are consequences. to our conduct. This is a metaphor of death, in my opinion, and not just mine, but others. And we, as we read this, and the great old black Baptist preachers would have taken this and run with it for all it's worth. Moses on the mountaintop dying, a metaphor of our own death. How do we live? How do we die? I think first impressions, of course, are very overrated. It matters the lasting impression. First can be very badly mistaken. But the lasting impression is the one that stays. And so we have this question that's posed, not just what matters to God, but how do we respond to what matters to God? Will we be haunted by a bucket list that's undone? There's always something else and something more. Always. We're never finished. Never. Is there something unsaid? Is there something undone? Are there dreams and wishes that are unfulfilled? Just assume the answer is in the affirmative. Yes. Life is short, and we are not capable of any perfection. And so then we know that we cannot reduce our life to achievements. But what God wants from us is not a life of achievements, although Moses has a resume to beat us all. What matters is a life of devotion. Not achievements, although they will come from the devotion. But what matters to God is our commitment, our loyalty, our willingness, our sacrificial service unto Him. On the epitaph of the tombstone undiscovered of Moses would surely be written, "Man of God, servant of the Lord." Those are the two most prominent phrases or high compliments that he receives in the Pentateuch and then later. He's a man of God, defined by God in the composition and image of God, but for the sake of God. He's a servant for the Lord, of the Lord, from the Lord, by the Lord, to the Lord. He puts God first. He has knowledge that led to wisdom, to understanding, to behaviors that were indicative of a life of devotion. He did not serve his own aspiration, but rather God's expectations. And we could say in the end that he lived well, but not perfect. And he died well, faithful in the end. And perhaps for Moses there would be a reference to Psalm 48, which is the basis for rest in peace. In Psalm 48, we hear these comforting words, "In peace I will recline and rest. The Lord makes me to dwell in safety." And in the end, our goal in life is to have the peace that passes all understanding. It's not the absence of conflict or the absence of hardship, but rather the serenity of God's power and purpose and presence with us, which is the very definition of peace. And because of that power and presence and purpose with us, we can indeed stop the cycles of life for a moment, simply recline and meditate and reflect and listen. And because of that peace that passes all understanding, we can rest safely in the hands of the Lord who has provided for us up until this very moment. Because in the end, for the people of God, for the followers of the Lord, for those who have been called into the kingdom of Christ, the Lord makes us to dwell in safety, visions and providence, in His goodness and tender mercies. And may it be so for us. Let's pray together.